A federal grand jury in Florida has indicted former U.S. President Donald Trump over his retention of sensitive government documents after he left the White House. Plus, the Red Cross warns that landmines could pose a threat for decades following the Kakhovka dam breach in Ukraine.
They could still be in minefields, or they could be in the middle of roads, someone's backyard, or in their own home.
And a nonprofit group in Maryland is using technology to help give current and former prisoners a chance at a better life. Today is Friday, June 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. In a stunning development, a federal grand jury in Florida indicted former U.S. President Donald Trump on Thursday over his retention of sensitive government documents after he left the White House. The Justice Department informed Trump that he has been indicted and asked him to make his first court appearance in Miami on Tuesday, the former president confirmed on his social media platform. The indictment remains under seal, but seven news outlets citing sources familiar with the case said it contains several criminal charges. In a request for a search warrant for Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate last year, the FBI listed three statutes that may have been breached. The first is part of the Espionage Act, which prohibits the unauthorized transmission or retention of national defense information, such as classified government documents. Another statute concerns obstruction of a federal investigation by destroying, altering, or falsifying records. Violations of the two statutes are punishable by as much as 10 to 20 years in prison. And we'll have more on this developing story on our website. This comes after federal prosecutors have notified former U.S. President Donald Trump's attorneys that he's a target of an investigation into his handling of classified materials. Meanwhile, Trump's longtime loyal vice president, Mike Pence, is one of several challengers who have jumped into the Republican race to try to thwart the former president from capturing the party's presidential nomination for a third consecutive time. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman explains Pence wasted no time in doing what he previously hesitated to do, forcefully criticize his former boss's conduct in office.
On his 64th birthday, former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, for the first time, took direct aim at his own party's frontrunner, former President Donald Trump, in whose shadow he stood for 4 years.
I believe that anyone who puts themselves over the Constitution should never be president of the United States. And anyone who asks someone else to put them over the Constitution should never be president of the United States again.
When pro-Trump protesters stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, there were chants of "Hang Mike Pence" because of the then-vice president's refusal to follow the president's demand that he derail the process, formally declaring Joe Biden the 2020 election victor. As George Mason University political science professor Jeremy Mayer points out, with his qualifications, why is Pence polling in the low single digits among Republicans, and far behind Trump's closest challenger, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis?
The vice presidency has diminished him even more than it diminishes most vice presidents.
Only two out-of-office vice presidents have ever made it back by election to the White House. Whatever happens in next year's Republican primary election, Mike Pence has already made history, now becoming the first former U.S. vice president to directly challenge his one-time running mate. Steve Herman, VOA News. At the White House.
The Pentagon on Thursday also dismissed a report by the Wall Street Journal about Chinese plans to set up an electronic eavesdropping facility in Cuba. Pentagon Press Secretary Air Force Brigadier General Pat Ryder.
I can tell you based on the information that we have that that is not accurate, that we are not aware of China and Cuba developing any type of spy station.
Earlier this year, the U.S. shot down a Chinese spy balloon over the Atlantic Ocean, but not before it traversed the breadth of the United States and flew over numerous military bases. New legislation is about to be introduced next week in the Australian Parliament that will ban the public display of Nazi symbols. Under the Counterterrorism Legislation Amendment Bill, offenders could face up to a year in prison. Phil Mercer has the details.
Among other things, the proposed bill will ban flags, T-shirts, armbands and other symbols related to the Nazis, an extremist German 20th century political party led by Adolf Hitler, and the Schutzstaffel, or SS, which was a major paramilitary organization. The symbols publication online will also be proscribed. The maximum penalty for breaching the ban would be 12 months imprisonment. The ban won't include the Nazi salute or the swastika, a symbol that has religious significance in Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism. Australia's Chief Law Officer, Attorney General Mark Dreyfus, said tackling far-right extremism was a priority for the government and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
The Albanese government will introduce legislation next week to criminalise public displays of the Nazi Hakenkreuz and the Schutzstaffel, or SS, hate symbols, and ban the trade in these items. Let's be clear, the Nazi salute is an offensive gesture. It has no place in Australian society, but we think that the banning of these gestures is a matter for state and territory laws.
Experts have welcomed the proposed new laws. They believe that Nazi symbols are weapons of intimidation and can help radical groups recruit new members, especially online. In April, Australia's intelligence agency told a parliamentary inquiry in Canberra that racist groups were using extremist symbols to raise their profile. Jewish groups in Australia also support the legislation. They've insisted the public display of Nazi symbols has been distressing for survivors of the Holocaust. Far-right extremists recently stood on the steps of the Victorian State Parliament House displaying the Nazi salute. Analysts have said it was evidence of a resurgence of Australia's white supremacist movement. Laws that criminalised the public display of Nazi symbols came into force in Victoria in late December 2022. New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, also banned the display of Nazi flags or memorabilia showing swastikas in 2022. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We're also following these stories from around the world. A Syrian national wounded four children and an adult in a knife attack in a park in the southeastern French town of Annecy on Thursday. The attacker was a Syrian national with legal refugee status in France and was not known to security agencies. His motives were unclear. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Thursday Saudi Arabia's reform efforts will be more successful if the kingdom expands human rights, as he concluded a visit aimed at repairing strained U.S.-Saudi relations. He also said Washington will press ahead with efforts to normalize diplomatic ties between its main Middle East allies, Saudi Arabia and Israel. The U.S. Capitol was shrouded in haze Thursday as hundreds of Canadian wildfires continued to send clouds of smoke across much of the eastern U.S., causing flight disruptions and prompting warnings from health officials. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Saturn's tiny ice-covered moon Enceladus caught the eye of scientists when NASA's Cassini mission first spotted plumes of water vapor blasting from the moon's surface at its southern pole region. With data gathered by Cassini, scientists theorized that there is a giant saltwater ocean deep inside the moon. It was found that these plumes of salty water and ice crystals feed Saturn's system, including its iconic rings. The James Webb Space Telescope recently focused on Enceladus and caught a close look at one of these plumes shooting over 9,600 kilometers above the moon's surface. Webb scientists also found that the flow rate of these plumes is about 300 liters of fluid per second. Enceladus, located within Saturn's E-ring, orbits its planet once every 33 hours with a cloud of water vapor following behind. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Red Cross is warning that landmines, uprooted and dispersed by floodwaters surging downstream from the breached Kakhovka Dam, could pose a grave danger to civilians for decades to come in Ukraine. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda takes it from here.
The flooding from the destruction of the Nova Kakhovka Dam in Ukraine is continuing to spread, now hitting the city of Mykolaiv. And the Red Cross is warning that one particular side effect of this disaster could pose an incredible danger to civilians even decades from now. Unexploded landmines and other munitions that have been swept away by the flood and now could literally be anywhere. They could still be in minefields, or they could be in the middle of roads, someone's backyard, or in their own home. As one Red Cross official put it, the only thing we do know is that the mines are somewhere downstream. Andrew Mathewson is with the Halo Trust, an NGO that clears landmines and has been working in the Mykolaiv region.
The immediate threat to us and our staff and civilians is the fact that mines might move, and that will, you know, that will lead to the need for us to resurvey these areas, remark them as minefields. And obviously reorganize ourselves in terms of how to approach the clearance problem. Beyond that, the mines might not only move, but they might also fluctuate in terms of the way they're laid, which poses another risk. We've seen 5,000 mines in that region in the last month alone. It's basically impossible to give an estimate. I mean, the contamination is so massive. The conflict is ongoing. The size of Ukraine itself, you know, the front line is 1,200 miles. Unfortunately, it's just really impossible to say. That could be, could be 1%, could be 0.0001.
Meanwhile, evacuations from the flood are ongoing, but the fighting around it hasn't stopped. Ukrainian authorities said Thursday that a civilian was killed and several others wounded in what they called targeted strikes by Russian shelling in one of the cities hit by the flood, Kherson. Russia also accuses Ukraine of shelling rescue workers in parts of the region that it occupies.
Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters News. The dam collapse has also brought a dramatic new dimension to Ukraine's war with Russia, which is now in its 16th month. Flashpoint Ukraine host Lori London talked about the implications for the conflict going forward with Michael Purcell, a professor at George Washington University, as well as a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Marines. She began their conversation by asking Purcell for his perspective on what the collapse of the Kakhovka Dam has on the war.
It's a distraction from what the Ukrainians wanted to be doing right now. So in terms of the strategic focus, we've all been watching and sort of waiting for the much anticipated counteroffensive. There's a significant amount of Western support that's gone into that. So I think they're under political pressure to show some results. And instead of talking about that, today we're talking about this ecological disaster on a scale that's hard to contemplate, and it's going to add to the reconstruction costs. So it's not as if it's an unimportant event, right? But it is a diversion from what they want to be accomplishing. And if we're keeping tabs, this notches an advantage to Russia in that sense, as the Ukrainians attempt to deal with humanitarian fallout. Let me list these out kind of quickly then, right? Let's think about three things. One is a strategic diversion away from Ukraine's strategic goals, which is to get Russia out of Ukraine. Secondly, it's a constraint on what Ukraine can do now operationally. So the lower Dnipro or Dnieper River is now flooded, so their ability to maneuver across that river in any kind of offensive is now much more limited than it was previously. And then lastly, it's another opportunity for the Ukrainians to, sadly, at a significant price, make their case to the international community that Russia is an irresponsible actor.
Do you expect that they will continue to attack Ukrainian infrastructure on this scale? Or do you think that the condemnation will be harsh enough that they may think twice?
At the risk of sounding cynical, and I don't say that flippantly, but I've become accustomed to obfuscation and Russian behavior being in bad faith. So what does that mean? It means that we would be unwise to consider anything more than this to be a red line. It may be, right, if we talk a lot about will the Russians use nuclear weapons, and the question sometimes is would they use tactical, battlefield, smaller yield weapons, nuclear weapons? And our assumption is they wouldn't because of the blowback in the international community that they would receive. This is something less than that, but it's not dissimilar, right? I mean, it is a significant, the impact of this is something like you would have from a tactical nuclear weapon in terms of scope and depth. The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant right there, right, which is the largest in Europe, is at greater risk now. And the idea that somehow it could be subject to fighting or destruction and turn into effectively a massive dirty bomb now, I think, is closer to the forefront of our mind. So in terms of what the Russians might do, I think you could look at this, a military planner might look at this and say, this is the first step up a ladder of escalation towards, not to overstate the case, but towards nuclear weapons or effects that are similar to nuclear weapons through environmental disaster or something similar.
Do you see this setting Ukraine back?
Yeah, I think, let's think about near term and long term, right? And in the near term, once again, it's a diversion from what they want to be doing right now. But in the long term, if the question is, does it set Ukraine back? The answer is certainly yes.
George Washington University's Michael Purcell speaking to my colleague, Lori London. And for more of their conversation and additional updates on the war, be sure to listen to our podcast, Flashpoint Ukraine. Pakistanis traditionally give generously to charity, but most avoid paying taxes. Now, charities are feeling the pressure as donations drop amid record-setting 38% inflation. Low tax collection, meanwhile, hurts economic growth, forcing more to rely on charities for survival. VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman has that story.
Every day, thousands of Pakistanis come to one of the Selani Welfare Trust's free food distribution centers spread across the country for a hot meal. Security guard Mohammad Khurshid is one of them. He says if the free food from Selani wasn't available, he would be spending all his salary on just food. With an annual inflation rate of almost 38% eating through people's incomes, Selani, one of Pakistan's largest charities, is seeing a rise in daily demand for its free food, but a drop in donations. Suhail Ahmed is a regional manager with the charity. He says that up until a few months ago, he used to get 30,000 pieces of bread made. Now, the number has reached almost 42,000. Donations have reduced, but Selani has not cut down its work, he adds. Charitable giving is a big part of Pakistani culture. In a 2021 Gallup Pakistan survey, around 76% of the respondents said they had given money to help someone in the year before. At the same time, the proportion of Pakistanis who pay taxes has always remained dismally low. The country's tax-to-GDP ratio is below 10%, meaning the government receives less than 10% of the size of the economy in taxes. What most countries need to sustain economic growth, according to experts, is a tax-to-GDP ratio of at least 15%. Economic research Ali Khizr says in Pakistan, huge sectors such as agriculture, trade, retail, and real estate use political muscle to keep their taxes low.
These sacred cows have presence in the parliament. These sacred cows have very strong lobbying in the military establishment. They are very much entrenched in those who are making the decision.
A complicated taxation system, ineffective implementation, and lack of trust in the government also cause many to evade taxes. Broadening the tax net and increasing collection are among the conditions for reviving a stalled 2019 International Monetary Fund bailout deal. However, authorities will likely miss the target. With Pakistan teetering on the brink of default and millions getting pushed into poverty because of the rising cost of food and fuel, pressure on charities like Selani is growing, says regional manager Ahmed. He says they're very worried that their work may stop, but will try their best to prevent that from happening. Sarah Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
And finally, a nonprofit group in Maryland is using technology to help give current as well as former prisoners a chance at a better life by training them to become auto technicians. Julie Tabo rounds us out.
At this working garage in Halethorpe, Maryland, students are learning how to fix cars.
Bring the RPM up a little bit.
Most are former prisoners, eager to become auto technicians.
You want to test the fuses?
Maurice Neal is one of the students.
I learned about this program while in prison, and what it does, it trains you and prepares you to be in the workforce.
The hands-on training is part of a paid internship program created by Vehicles for Change, a 24-year-old nonprofit that fixes donated cars and provides them to low-income families at low cost. Martin Schwartz, is president and founder of the organization.
Our guys spend 4 months here, they train up, they take the student ASE exams, and then when they graduate, we're able to place them in with our employment partners throughout the region.
3, 2, 1.
The program includes training using virtual reality, or VR, technology. Student Chucky Fleet.
With this, you get the mindset before you get the hands-on.
Which is the whole idea, says Jeff Crawford, who's head of the virtual reality program.
What I love about it is how immersive the technology is. Being able to go into a headset and being able to be single focus on something, have it kind of gamified to make something fun, is, I think, a great way to learn, especially when you're in an entry-level position.
More than 250 people have gone through the training program, with 95% having found jobs, the nonprofit says. For many, it's a chance at a better life. Student Chucky Fleet.
Without this program, I probably would be back in prison. There's no more prison for me, thanks to these guys.
Using VR technology to teach skills is more than just a trend, Crawford says.
So we really believe that this is just going to be the way of life in the world of profits and nonprofits.
The goal for this nonprofit is to expand the program nationally and eventually overseas. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Halethorpe, Maryland.
And that's going to do it for us today. This has been International Edition of the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, have a fantastic Friday, and an amazing weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 6, the Kakhova Dam in Ukraine's Kherson Oblast was breached and its hydroelectric power plant destroyed. The dam had been seized by Russian troops soon after the invasion of Ukraine began and is to this day under Russian control. And although it is not yet clear if the collapse was caused by structural failure or sabotage, there is no doubt that the collapse of the dam would not have happened if Russia had not attacked Ukraine. It was Russia that started this war. It was Russia that occupied this area of Ukraine, and it was Russian forces that took over the dam illegally last year and have been occupying ever since, said U.S. Alternate Representative for Special Political Affairs Robert Wood.
Deliberate attacks on civilian objects are prohibited by the law of war. As a party to Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions, Russia has an obligation not to attack works or installations containing, quote, dangerous forces, including dams, unquote, if such an attack may cause the release of dangerous forces and severe losses among the civilian population.
Indeed, in the words of Martin Griffiths, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, the destruction of the Kakhova Hydroelectric Power Plant Dam is one of the most significant incidents of damage to civilian infrastructure since the start of the Russian Federation's invasion of Ukraine. Furthermore, the dam's destruction undermines the stability of Ukraine's power supply and could create additional challenges to maintaining safety in and around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, said Ambassador Wood.
Zaporizhia nuclear power plant's cooling pond, which draws water from the dam's reservoir, must maintain its integrity and access to water, which is essential for cooling the reactors and their spent fuel. We call on Russia to reconnect the sensors that automatically report data to Ukraine civilian regulators and to allow the IAEA to ensure the international community has reliable information on any radioactivity around the plant.
The United States will continue to work with the international community to hold Russia to account for its aggression. We will continue to support Ukraine to defend itself in the face of the Kremlin's brutality, said Ambassador Wood. The way forward is clear. Russia must withdraw its troops from Ukraine's internationally recognized borders. It must end this war, and it must end the untold human suffering it has wrought.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
We'll be right back.